ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I got very used to sort of crawling out of bed and coming and curling up behind an open, half-open door in, you know, the wooden house that we would have lived in those days, where my parents were playing cards with friends or whatever. And I got used to overhearing what they said. And I think that was my first training, not to be a writer, but for being a writer.
David Malouf was a giant of Australian writing, known and loved for his iconic debut novel, Jono, about a young man in Brisbane during the Second World War, a book partly inspired by his own life. In a career spanning more than 50 years, David wrote plays, poetry, libretto, and more novels, including The Great World and his Booker Prize shortlisted Remembering Babylon. And today on this special episode of The Book Show, we're remembering David, who has died this week at the age of 92. Now, I had the very, very great pleasure of speaking to David just last year. He had just re-released some collections of his poetry, but we talked about all sorts of things, his early life, sharing books with his mum, that first novel, and the benefits of a daily walk on the beach. I started by asking David if writing was still a daily practice for him. And his answer, as you'll hear, was bittersweet.
No. I don't write any fiction, which is, you know, what keeps you to a routine of having to work every day. And if I have an idea for a poem or the beginnings of a poem, I jot it down, and if the poem comes, that's good. If it doesn't, I say to myself, which is quite true, that I've already done enough, so I don't feel any pressure.
That must feel nice.
Well, it means you have to make your life work each day with other things. And if you've actually been a writer who was used to writing, holding your life together, that's not so easy.
Yeah. So what do you do? What makes up your day?
Oh, some reading. I my eyes are not great for the moment, so I can only read really by daylight. So I do some reading. I do walk on the beach every day, which is great.
Beautiful. And you were saying, you know, if you get the beginnings of a poem, I'm interested to know what that moment is like, David. Can that come at any moment? Does it come when you're walking? When does a poem begin to stir?
Oh, it depends what it's set off by. It might be set off by hearing something somebody says. It might be set off by perceiving something that strikes you as new. It's often set off by language. So reading, and often misapprehension in reading, is what brings a phrase to mind that can be the beginning of a poem.
When you say misapprehension, you mean like a line that rubs you up the wrong way? Or
no, no, I mean a line that you misread. And it's exactly that kind of odd misreading which constitutes the kind of liveliness of a new use of language which belongs to the world of poetry.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you never made the move to writing on a computer, I believe. So if you're writing any of these poems, it's still by hand. Why did you never do that?
I mean, I'm not very good even at typing, so I don't like to type. So I've never wanted to use a computer. But I also think there's something about the pace at which you're hand moves, and the pace at which the mind moves allows you, when you're writing by hand, to have second thoughts as well as first thoughts. And I think it all happens so quickly on the computer that sometimes something gets said, and once it's said and in print, it seems good enough. That is very different from the kind of way your mind and hand work together when you're handwriting. And so I think, for me anyway, the pace at which my mind needs to work when I'm writing, either prose or poetry, is related to the pace at which I can write.
Do you still have the handwritten manuscripts of your novels?
I have had, yes. And they're there because I usually do the first, or did, the first typewritten version, which was pretty untidy. And as I say, I'm not a very good typist. And then it would go to someone who would make a clean typescript for me, and I would begin to correct that.
Right. We're speaking today, David, because you've re-released three collections of poetry, including your latest poetry collection, An Open Book. And I wanted to talk about the almost title poem from that collection, a poem called The Open Book. It begins with, "My mother could read me, or so she claimed, like a book. Fair warning. But I too was a reader and knew that books, like houses, have their secrets." It's a beautiful poem, David, and I love this image of a young David Malouf as an open book, learning to stay quiet, waiting for the plot to thicken. It struck me reading that poem, David, that in order to be a storyteller, first you have to be a listener.
Well, I would say that. I would say even more than that, what you have to be is an eavesdropper. And I think of myself as a small child being a very, very consistent but also a very clever eavesdropper, because I discovered that very early, I think, but this was mostly in a world of women, and that's one of the things that you don't always think of, that if you grow up as a child, even as a boy, you mostly grow up for the first 5 years in a world of women. And I got very, very used to listening in to what my mother and her friends were talking about while they had a cup of tea or played cards or whatever they were doing. And I learned from that a lot that I was told by my parents or allowed to see and hear by my parents was not the whole story and not the whole truth. And once I discovered that, that became an obsession, I think, with me. And I became very, very clever at getting myself into a situation in which I could overhear what people were saying when they thought they were not being listened to. And other than that, I got very used to sort of crawling out of bed and coming and curling up behind an open, half-open door in, you know, the wooden house that we would have lived in those days, where my parents were playing cards with friends or whatever. And I got used to overhearing what they said. And I think that was my first training, not to be a writer, but for being a writer.
Do you still eavesdrop?
I think I do, yes. And look, I think any writer will tell you that they love sitting on a bus and overhearing conversations in that kind of way or something, because a lot of experience comes to you, not directly, but indirectly through observation. And I think it was Henry James who first pointed out that you only needed at the smallest degree of at a glance, or what you heard through an open door, or what somebody dropped in conversation. And if you were a writer, that was the kind of first line on a whole page for your way of dealing with experience, whereas it wouldn't necessarily be that with someone who was not an active writer.
So when did you know that you wanted to make writing your life?
Oh, fairly late, I think. I, as a child, I thought I wanted to be other things. I was a musician. I played the violin, and I would have liked to be a composer. I think that was a preoccupation of mine until I was 12 or 13. After that, I thought I wanted to be an actor. And I did a kind of course in acting, you know, out of school hours. I really discovered I was a writer when I found I had a good many poems as it was then written. But, you know, by the time I was 15 or 16, I had a typewriter then, and I was working on a typewriter, writing stories. And in fact, I won a school prize when I was 12 for a short story I'd written, which was an inaugural prize and was open to anybody of any age in the school. So it was extraordinary when a 12-year-old in the first year of high school kind of won it. But that didn't necessarily assure me that what I was meant to be was a writer. But what I'm saying is that I had a certain kind of assurance as a writer, which meant that I would eventually produce things, and that when I had a certain body of work and looked at it, I could decide that one day perhaps I would be either a poet or a short story writer, a fiction writer, although I became a fiction writer quite late. I'd written many poems and published many poems, and a couple of volumes of poems before I felt that something I had written in prose was worth keeping and publishing.
And that was Jono?
It was some stories first, and then it was Jono, yes.
What about your parents? Were they supportive of this creative kid who wanted to be a composer or a writer or definitely something creative? And what did they make of that?
Oh, they were very, very supportive. I mean, my mother was a great reader, and we often read together. I mean, when the war was on, we went to Scarborough, which is a small swimming place in south of Brisbane. And there, my mother and I belonged to the local library in Redcliffe, and every book that she borrowed from there, I read. So we shared a huge amount of reading. And she went on doing that when I went to university and brought home the books that I was now reading, or the books that were set. She read every single one of them. So we had a very, very close relationship about reading and about talking about reading. And she and the a woman who was really our housekeeper nurse, they used to read novels aloud to one another every afternoon. And that was another time when I sort of sat quietly in the room and listened.
I've read that your mum, she'd come to Australia from England. She didn't like you kids sounding too Australian. Is that right?
Oh, yes. She wouldn't let us use Australian slang much. And I mean, we were not allowed to call a shilling a bob. And there were certain things we couldn't do. We were not allowed to put but at the end of the sentence, which is what kids in Queensland certainly do as part of the local dialect. So she was very, very conscious of the language we were using. Yeah.
And then, of course, now you're well regarded as this, you know, great Australian writer and this great writer of the Australian language. I mean, I wonder what your mum would make of that.
Oh, I think she would recognise that as being a necessary use of the local dialect.
You're allowed that one.
Yeah.
Your first novel, David Maloof, was Jono. It was published in 1975. And at this point, it is an iconically Brisbane novel about a lifelong friendship between two boys. I'm interested to know if that book started with those boys or if it started with the city itself.
Partly, I think it started with the city itself. And the city is the third character in the book, you know, often discussed and by the two people and rejected utterly by the Jono character, and also half rejected by the narrator, But the narrator realizes that that's what he's been given. And, you know, if you were given a wonderful city, I thought, in those days, like London or St. Petersburg or Paris, like Dante, Florence, you were lucky, until I actually realized, of course, which I had always known, that those cities which those writers pass on to us and which we accept as being as they are presenting them are really invented. And so I had realized before I really started Jono, that if I was going to write about a place called Brisbane, what I would be doing would be inventing it and only pretending to have been having it passed on to me as a second kind of city in Worth. It could be made rather than just described. And in doing that, of course, you are creating it for readers who've never been there, never seen it, but who, while they are reading the book, feel this is the city I'm in.
Over the years, you've published fiction, you've published non-fiction, poetry, opera, librettos, a play. I'm wondering at this point, you know, when you look back at everything you've done, you know, and thinking even perhaps about these poetry collections that you're re-releasing as an example, can you look back at this work with a great sense of pride and accomplishment? Or are there, you know, things there that you want to change, you want to fix, you wish you could do again?
Oh, I think that's not true of any of the fiction, but I think poetry particularly, you look back on certain poems you wrote, and I wouldn't want them put in the collection that I am now preparing of books that, of poems that I want preserved. They're either too clever, which I don't like, or they're satirical in what I think of now as a mean-spirited way. And so those poems I don't want kept. They'll still be there and available to people who want to see what was left out. But I think, you know, towards the end of your time, especially with poetry, you want to yourself make the choice of the poems you think that are worth reading. And that's not always accurate. I mean, often, you know, readers will like poems that you yourself don't like anymore.
I found it interesting when you said you were, you know, not so into the poems that you found mean-spirited. Does that suggest a kind of softening in you, David?
I think it is a lack of respect or patience any longer with a previous you who found it too easy to make superior judgments.
Yeah, that's, I think, something a lot of people would identify with. David Malouf, I'm interested in your take on the Australian publishing scene today. I've seen writing where you've said that you were glad that you weren't really pigeonholed into a certain publishing identity, for example, a Lebanese writer or a gay writer. What do you make of where things are at right now?
Look, I think there was something that happened really in publishing 30 years ago now. And it was that when somebody took a first book to a publisher, the publisher looked at it, and if they decided to publish, they would tell the writer which niche market they felt the writer belonged to, and they would suggest and work very strongly to see that what he kept to was what that niche market would buy. And I never accepted that at all. And I was very, very lucky because I had already written, say, in Jono, which was followed immediately by An Imaginary Life, books, novels, as they appeared to be, works of fiction, that were so unlike one another that they were likely to have picked up what any publisher would call a niche market. And so I was free to write anything I wanted. And I think that's how it always had once been, that you, as a writer, only discover after 3-4 books what the range of your writing is, and therefore what the range of your readership might be. And really believing that you now have a readership who will go along with you wherever you take them is how you keep writing.
You're listening to a special episode of The Book Show where we're remembering the Australian novelist, poet and playwright David Malouf. David had an incredible career spanning more than 50 years. And when he and I talked last year, he just re-released some of his poetry, including a new poem called Coda. It's a poem which is even more striking after his death. Here he is explaining the context.
It's a poem about the point at which you lose control of your life in many ways, and what action you take about that, how you accept it. So it's about the arrival of the angel of death, probably, and who is no longer either you or any one of the projections of yourself that you had previously used, projections of your writing self. And it's someone now who's about to take over, and it's whether you accept that or reject it and how you do that.
I'd love to hear it if you're happy to read it, David.
Coda. The better question, not when or how, but who, when the hour arrives precisely on cue, will be there on the doorstep, armed with a name, a face, a family likeness, to claim reunion. Out of a stack of counterparts or strangers that my writing self conjured up to this or that occasion as a stand-in, then sent packing, and who now simply appears, as if the moment this time around was his, and I the shade that must fill it. My breath in his mouth, my pen in his hand, the compact between us finally sealed with no escape clause, and on my part, no option but with good grace to stand aside and bid him welcome.
David Malouf, who has died at the age of 92. This has been a special episode of The Book Show made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. I'm Claire Nichols. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.